Okay, today we're going to continue Tuesday's session and talk about nonviolence and how we might live that out in a very personal way. And then on tomorrow morning, talk about how nonviolence might be applied to even our national defense in a much more corporate way. I'm going to talk today, though, vis-a-vis a very specific, particular situation, and hope that at the end of the discussion we can make some connections to the rest of our lives and even on a corporate scale. We'll talk about that today. But again, the general theme is picking up on what John talked about on Tuesday as nonviolence, not as a weakness, but not as inaction, but as a form of power. Session today will take up the question that's most often put to pacifists: what would you do if someone dependent upon you life were being threatened? Has anyone ever heard that question asked?
Many.
I'm going to just write it up on the board.
Can anyone phrase it in a different way that it's been asked to them?
It's often someone has broken into your house and is about to stab your infant child, or in other words, an aggressor about to harm or kill a very innocent party, and you are able to intervene or choose not to intervene or something. Is that what you talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. If you make it a case study, then you would picture a very innocent person, a aggressive, try to make it premeditated with intent to harm or kill. You make it dramatic if you want to.
The scenario is often in the bedroom. That's why the announcement this morning that someone comes in the middle of the night to your bedroom and tries to kill your wife or your child.
Rape.
Anyone else heard it in a different way?
Rape your husband.
Rape your husband. Okay.
I thought you said in the first war, in the second war, to meet little troops fresh from the farm, what would you do if a German soldier were raping your sister?
Okay.
And the mean little homosexual said, I would interpose myself in between.
Scratch that from the table.
Moving right along. I do have to say that this actually happened to me once. The situation.
That?
No, this. But I gave the session last spring, and a couple of people in Winter Program who knew I was going to give the session in the morning burst into my room at about 1 in the morning. Someone had planted themselves about 2 minutes before in the bed across from me. I was in one of the old Koinonia rooms, and Tim Kishner came in with a nylon over his head and a toy gun and threatened that he was going to kill my wife, and he wanted to see exactly what I would do in that instance, and I just turned over and fell asleep again.
She did.
I'm speaking from experience to some extent. We ask this question because it seems like as soon as you begin to say more than, let's say, a particular war is ineffective or illegitimate, as soon as you go beyond that and say that all war is wrong, or as soon as you start sounding like a pacifist, challenges begin to come to you from all sides, and it could be from professors, from family members, from the draft board, or whoever, challenging your consistency, the consistency of your stance, and by asking you whether or not you would defend your own, and you can fill in the blank, your own wife, your child, your husband, against an insane or a criminal attacker. And the assumption is that this question fairly represents the issue of war, and that if someone cannot immediately answer the question, then his or her pacifist stance is immediately refuted. Today we're going to try to show, first of all, that this question does not bear the direct relationship to war that we assume that it usually has, and also show how we've misused this question and how we've tended to prejudice the decision we make by limiting ourselves to a view of reality that's much more narrow than the Christian faith calls for. So I think it also fits into our theme of seeing differently. I think we want to see reality in a much different way, is to widen up the options that we have in a particular situation like this. I'm going to be using today a an analysis of this ethical case that was written by Mennonite scholar John Howard Yoder, who's written a number of books in the library, including The Politics of Jesus and The Original Revolution, and a little book called Nevertheless. And it's because I read this book and have a habit of closely following footnotes that I came upon this ethical case study in one of the footnotes in the back of this book. But I found this book very helpful in first considering pacifism and trying to figure out where I stood. And the other two books, Politics of Jesus and The Original Revolution, as very helpful as far as biblical support goes. But Yoder denies that this is really an important question in the first place, that it's representative of the issue of war. But he does take it seriously in order to point out its limitations and its inconsistencies and its shortcomings. But we're going to take a look at it today. And first of all, notice that the argument is presented to be a personal threat, but then it's always used in direct comparison to modern war. Yoder will constantly be calling that into question as an assumption that we can go with. We've naturally assumed that this very individualized and personalized threat in one's bedroom applies directly to modern war and to the issues of national defense. So, moving on, I think, first of all, what we have to do in looking at this question, what would you do if someone depended on you were being attacked, is look at some underlying assumptions that need to be confronted before we start. And if you ever read Yoder, you'll realize that that's his style, that he's very direct, and he'll immediately call into question the assumptions that we come with in the first place. Yoder says, there's simply no such thing as a simple situation dictating a particular line of action. In other words, we have to start by confronting some underlying assumptions. You can't simply interpret the situation with any meaning without identifying a context of prior assumptions that we come with. So before we look at the situation, we need to be aware of how it's worded and how it's posed as an ethical case, because the way it's posed will have a lot to do with how we go about answering the question. So he outlines about five or six of those assumptions that I want to quickly go over. First one has to do with just the way it's worded. What would you do if someone dependent upon you were being attacked? Question assumes that it's a case where I alone am making a decision and no one else. And Yoder says that assumes that we live in, he says it's determinism. In other words, it assumes we live in a deterministic, mechanistic world that, in other words, the world is like a machine, that if I turn the machine one way, it will inevitably go one direction. If I press some other buttons, it will obviously go another direction, that I can be exactly sure what will happen when I make a certain decision. It doesn't really take into account that the decisions I make are based upon the rest of the world or the society that I live in, or at least the other people in the room. The question is so pre-programmed that it looks like nothing else could happen. The attacker is pre-programmed to make one decision. He wants to kill. He wants to do the worst possible evil. There isn't anyone else in the situation whose actions might get in the way of what is already pre-programmed. So obviously it's up to me to steer things in the right direction. Yoder says this is obviously a deterministic situation like this is obviously unrepresentative of the nature of war and the way we make decisions in the world. It's especially true on an international level where we have lots of different people making, and lots of different groups of people making decisions, and they're all based on what the other group is thinking. And the one thing you can be sure on an international level is that you can't be sure of anything. You don't know exactly how things are going to turn out because many other forces and people are acting at the same time, changing their actions, thus changing the situation of which we're all a part. Even on that level of the individual, Yoder says, it's not necessarily the case that I'm the only one making decisions in the room. That as if there are only two tracks on which events could go, and that I at some particular point decide which way those events are going to go. That if I kill the attacker, such and such is going to happen, or if I shoot the attacker, such and such is going to happen. If I don't shoot the attacker, something else is going to inevitably happen. And Yoder goes on to say, and I think this is an important point, that in some sense, if you commit yourself to this line of thinking in this deterministic way, that assumption will be self fulfilling in some way also. That if I tell myself there are no choices, that there are less likely to be other choices than if I had expected them, and still less if I had thought that I had the creative capacity or even the duty to make those other choices happen or those other possibilities happen. I think it's a very important part that we limit ourselves by thinking deterministically. Okay, any questions on that? Was it?
Yoder does think it is determinism.
Yeah, he thinks this question is posed to us in a deterministic way, as if only one or two things could happen, and that he says not an appropriate view of reality.
He rejects that.
But these are some of his critical observations of the initial assumptions of the question itself. Okay, the second point, Yoder says, the question assumes that I am in control of the situation. Something that we have to call into question. It assumes that if I want to stop the attacker, that I can. In some cases, that might be true, but in many cases, that's not true. The more serious the attacker, the less likely it will be that I'll actually be able to stop him. We talked about the just war theory, and something that I think we all hold to, that it's not reasonable to fight a war that one is sure to lose, because then we would suffer both from the evil that we inflict and the evil that we hope to prevent. And certainly that would be worse than if we would just willingly accepted the evil in the first place that threatened us. So Yoder says, his point is that we can't assume that by choosing the violent option we'll be successful. We can't always assume that we're that much in control. And he shows by simple logic that you can't always assume that violence is generally likely to be successful. He does it by just saying, in any war, one side always loses. And in some wars, both sides lose. So by a simple calculation of the probability, the chances are less than even that we'll be able to bring about successful results by harming the other party. And he said that's true on both levels, on the individual level because the attacker is prepared to fight, and on the international level because in the many ways that war can be turned around very quickly without one group being completely in control, especially today when we have lots of nations with nuclear weapons. There's no way to tell that if we choose the violent option, that it's necessarily going to be successful, and that's something that this question assumes is true. Third point, and it's a minor point, I guess, is that we view it as an individual matter. And not only is that not true in relation to the institutional dimensions of war, but it doesn't even fit the case in point. The person who's being attacked is also a responsible being and would probably be part of my decision-making process. In other words, another person in the room who I'm supposed to be concerned about. It's not only me. And if this person, let's say it's my wife, this person shares my value commitments, then she would also be guided by some of the same considerations as I would as to how to treat my enemy. So it doesn't seem, Yoder says, it doesn't seem too out of line for me to deal with the enemy as she would want me to, assuming this is someone that's close to me. So concern for the other in a different way than we might think of in the first place. The fourth point says has to do with righteousness. The way the question is posed, it assumes my righteousness. It assumes not only that I'll be able to calculate what will bring about a successful ending, but it assumes that I have the right to do that. In this instance, I have to be the authority morally to be the judge, the jury, and the executioner in my own case. It assumes that that I can be honest with a hard decision even when it involves my own interests as opposed to someone else's. And so we have to call that into question. It's really questionable in the case of nations. There's even less reason to assume that a nation is capable of standing in judgment over itself in its own temptations. We all know that it's more likely for a group of people to have less capacity for self-criticism than an individual. But he says that's something that we have to call into question, that we can be our own jury, judge, and executioner in our own case, even when it involves our own interests as opposed to someone else's. Fifth one is that the way the question is defined, let's see, what attacker's motives. The way the question is defined, it excludes the possibility that the attacker might have some reasons for doing what he's doing. Not that he's morally right in attacking me or my wife, but the question leaves no room for the possibility that perhaps the attacker is a poor person looking for bread in the home of someone who has more bread than they need. Perhaps a person could be an oppressed person rising up to destroy a symbol of an oppressive order, however wrong that may be. The question is posed such that we can't even ask that. We assume that the attacker is insane and has absolutely no motives for doing what he's doing. And we have to call that beginning of that prior assumption into question before we even look at what we would answer. Okay, Yoder goes on then to look at some of the emotional aspects of the question that affect how we try to answer it. Remember, the question is usually given to pacifists who have made a stance on war. So supposedly this question has to do with our concern for war. But Yoder says when the focus of the problem is shifted from the level of war or the general level of loving your neighbor to the specific case of protecting my loved ones in an individual situation, that has a big impact on the way we're going to answer the question. And so, in other words, Yoder says the way, because of the way it's worded, this case moves us away from the ethical decision we want to get at. Instead of getting at what generally is right and wrong, it personalizes and it emotionalizes the problem by making it my own self-defense, sort of with the unspoken social pressure that if I do not live up to my principles, if I do not respond to this brutal threat in a brutal way, then somehow I will not have been a man. There's all sorts of emotional issues in here that aren't necessary to get to the question of what is right and wrong, but in this question it seems like they're maximized. It maximizes the emotion, which isn't really necessary. And I think there is some, Janet, you know, mentioned raping my husband, but there is some sort of sexism in the way that the question is posed, because it's, at least in my experience, it's always been posed as a woman being attacked by a man, and it's the man's responsibility to defend the woman. It's never the other way around, that the man is being attacked and the woman is supposed to defend the man. So to keep that in mind, that the way it is posed has a lot to do with the way we'll answer it. And if it's personalized like that, it brings us away from the question we want to get at, general love of one's neighbor. Yoder says the emotionalism comes out in another way. The argument seems to be posed and seems to ask a question about my protecting someone else. Whether to love my neighbor by taking care of someone else other than myself who is in need. This comes out when you might have heard people say, oh, I would have the right or perhaps the duty in some cases to sacrifice my own welfare to be loving toward an attacker, but I have no right to sacrifice the welfare of others for whom I'm responsible. Have you ever heard anyone say that? That if it were just me, I might have the right or the duty to be loving to an attacker, but when it involves someone else, a loved one, or someone else for whom I'm responsible, I have no right to sacrifice their welfare. Yoder says this really distorts the nature of the argument by making it sound like it's some sort of unselfish concern for other people, when it's really a form of egoism to defend my wife or child precisely because they're my own. He says it's a form of egoism to defend my wife or child precisely because they're my own. Let me explain what you mean. The argument doesn't say anything about my responsibility to defend, for instance, the wives and children of El Salvadorian peasants whom are being persecuted with support from our government. In this argument, the reason I would defend my wife and child is not because they're my neighbors, not because they're innocent third parties, but precisely because they are mine. And he says that's what we're actually talking about is moving away from talking about loving my neighbor and instead talking about an act that's self-oriented in nature. So we have to confront that. And he doesn't mean to say that taking care of one's own or defending one's what is one's own is... he says that defending someone who's close to you is not wrong in a selfish sense necessarily. In fact, you could say that it's simply a part of loving and serving everyone, and that you just have to start closest to home. But Yoder says that when I threaten, it has to do with our understanding of who the neighbor is in this situation. When I threaten that attacker, he's the one with whom I'm dealing in that situation, and he's my neighbor. And I think that's an interesting point. When I threaten the life of that attacker, he is my neighbor in that context, And if I'm going to distinguish between two near neighbors and say that the nearness of my family member takes priority over the nearness of the other victim, he says, Yoder says, that's egoism. That's structurally egoism, and we have to justify that. Because there are two near neighbors in that instance. One is the attacker, one's my family member. If I'm going to choose the family member over the attacker, I have to justify that because it's a form of egoism. And he says, for us as Christians, we're going to have to justify that in the light of a gospel that sort of downplays myself and my survival and affirms the dignity of the enemy.
I'm understanding his egoism in this context of how, you know, self-concern, maybe, if you think, but I can't relate if my brother was being killed, how I'd be concerning myself so much as I would be just emotionally overwrought to defend him.
Okay, Yoder says that in this case, at least, the reason you're defending that person is not because they're an innocent bystander, but because they are your brother, wife, child. He says that may be a good thing to do, but it's a form of egoism because you're choosing to kill someone else in favor of your own brother. And he said that has to be justified because there are two, in that context, there are two people in the room, both of those persons are your neighbor. And when you threaten the life of that attacker, that's the one whom you're dealing with. And if you're going to choose the nearness of your brother as opposed to the nearness of that attacker, you have to justify that in some way. And he says, for Christians, we have to justify that on the basis of a gospel that says the self is not that important, my survival is not that important, and a gospel which elevates the dignity of the attacker and the enemy and the offender. Love your enemy, do good to those who hate you, bless those who persecute you. And I think that's something that we have to confront. One reason, though, that...
Answer my question on egoism.
Okay.
I still don't understand, but that one. How he uses the word egoism in that context.
I think an act of self-interest.
As opposed to just defending the injustice.
Right, right. Does everyone understand that? Was that clear?
So he says that those people are your neighbor.
The one with whom you deal is your neighbor.
And that to choose one over the other is...
To choose your family member over a foreign attacker. So that has to be justified in some way because there are two people who are your neighbor in that room.
How does he explain that just being someone being unjustly attacked?
Yeah, okay. One of the reasons that we might choose to kill the attacker is because the attacker is a guilty person that's coming and trying to kill my innocent loved one. So that might be a reason to choose to harm or kill the attacker.
You cannot choose either to make a decision where you don't take that choice between this, my brother, or the attacker. That's not an ego.
Explain again.
If I didn't make that choice to defend my brother, if I chose to love my attacker and my brother, that's not an egotistical choice. That's not egoism.
Well, he says that to justify killing one or the other, if you killed for your family member, that would be a form of self-interest.
Yeah,
it could be a form of self-interest too, also if you acted in a different way, but you wouldn't be killing for that self-interest. He doesn't say the self-interest is necessarily bad.
It's going to be
egoism
either way, but you're going to be killing for egoism one way.
Right.
But won't you be potentially allowing a death the other way? Is that not a form of killing?
Okay, that's a question we're going to get to.
Okay.
Going on, he says one of the reasons that we could say that we would harm the attacker instead of just let it happen is because he's a guilty one attacking an innocent person. The Yoder says, as Christians, we have to ask if this argument really holds the same weight for us. Don't we as Christians proclaim forgiveness for our enemies? Killing the guilty one in defense of the innocent one might be a good argument, but Yoder's saying that here it's still... If this is your reason for making a decision to kill the attacker, then it's probably still a self-centered action, unless you could show that you also had ultimate concern for other innocent victims.
Do you have to kill?
The way this question is posed, you do. You have to show, if this is your reason for killing the attacker, you'd also have to show in some way that you're concerned for other innocent victims. And I don't think it's unfair to say, you know, we'd have to show concern for... you know, the children of El Salvadorian peasants, or Russian women and children, innocent people. Do I not have the same responsibility toward those people as I do toward my family member? We're going to have to show that some way. If that's our reason, because that person's innocent, then we're going to have to show that we have an ultimate concern for people all over the world who are innocent. And oftentimes, I don't think that we do that. Okay, I want to move on now to another point that Yoder has and list some more subpoints within that. Yoder says war is different. It's just simply different than this case study. At some points, it seems like there is no clear-cut analogy between self-defense and war. And I've heard people say before, I don't know, maybe you have too, gee, I'd certainly like to be a pacifist, but I don't think I could stand and watch my wife and child be killed. I don't think I could do that, therefore I cannot be a pacifist. Yoder might act a different way in that situation, but I think you would agree that if you thought it was your Christian duty to violently defend your wife or your child in that situation, you could also, without any inconsistency, completely reject all war. So if you chose, and if you thought it was your Christian duty to violently defend your wife and child, you still could reject all war. And Gandhi said that, Thomas Merton said that, they were both ready without any embarrassment to admit that you could violently defend your own family without seeing any compromise in the rejection of all forms of modern warfare or organized violence in a national cause. So Yoder's next point is that war is different enough so that there isn't that direct relationship. And he has a number of points under that. First one has to do with innocent bystanders. We're going to move to point the differences between this case study and the nature of war. Okay, in this case study, on an individual level, if I kill the attacker, it would be the guilty person that would be the target of my violence. In other words, there wouldn't be any chance of harming innocent bystanders. Although if you look at statistics show that more people are killed accidentally by guns intended against intruders than are actually killed by intruders. But let's just assume for now that there would be no chance for harming innocent bystanders. I would certainly not go to his home and harm his family. And I think this is an important distinction between this case and war. Whoever is the aggressor in a nuclear war, and I don't care whose fault it is or who's the guilty one, it is clear in a nuclear war that those who suffer from modern war are not the people who are attacking us directly. Most of the people who suffer from modern war are not the people who attack us directly. This is most clearly shown in the case of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. People who suffered, most of the people, practically all the people who suffered, were not the people who were directly attacking us. In fact, you could say it's the missilemen who are actively attacking us, or the generals who are giving the orders, who are less likely to actually be harmed than the civilians who are caught in the line of fire, at least in modern war. And I can use an example to make this point clear, and it might be more complicated of an example than need be, but I think it's interesting. And we go back to the situation in Vietnam. One of the biggest reasons for us for being involved in our venture in Vietnam was to keep us from someday needing to defend ourselves at our own shores from the Russians. Did you ever hear that argument? That was a major reason for us being involved in Vietnam, that they someday would be at our own back doorstep and we would have to defend ourselves at our own shore. That was one of the major reasons. Now if we go back to this question, to be fair to the logic of this question, we have to change around the image of the invader. Now, we are the attacker entering somewhat, you know, the fact that we chose to defend South Vietnamese over the North Vietnamese, you know, makes Vietnam as a place, as a place to fight the Russians or the communists. So Yoder says now that we are the attacker entering someone else's homeland on the grounds that sometime in the future one of their friends, the Russians, might attack us. Let me repeat that. And changes around the image of the invader here. We are the attacker now, entering someone else's homeland on the grounds that sometime in the future one of their friends might want to attack us. Yoder says that's just like it would be a man who would enter my house saying you must fight my wife because my friend might sometime want to attack his home. Understand that? Yeah. Is it too confusing? Let me repeat it once more. We're the attacker coming into someone else's homeland on the grounds that at some point one of their friends might want to attack us. That's like a man coming into my house saying he must fight my wife because my friend might sometime want to attack his home. This is the logic of that war, at least our most recent conflicts in Vietnam, and you can make some comparisons to El Salvador, is much different than this situation. Okay, second point has to do with authority. In this situation, we could say that the attacker is clearly in my home, so there's no problem with legitimate authority for me to kill that person because they've come into my home. So in war, it's not so clear-cut. Aggression is rarely clear-cut in war. The defense also rarely stays on its own ground. I think as Americans, we have to confront this because all of our wars since the Civil War have not been on our home ground. Also, in this case, the individual, in this individual case, the attacker and the victim and I all live in the same community. We all are subject to the same laws and legislation, so our actions are subject to review by the law. And that's not usually the case in war, Yoder says. There's no higher court to decide who's right or wrong much of the time. There's no regular procedure of review of who is justified. Okay, third point has to do with preparation. Another difference between this case and the case of war. Defending my home doesn't take much preparation. I might have a gun in my house, maybe. But in war, you can't even begin to participate in modern war these days without having, for years and years, made costly preparations. If I have a gun in my house, and let's say if my neighbors knew about it, perhaps it might stop a burglar. It might be a deterrent in some way. But when we pile up armaments, like Tridents, MX, missiles, ICBMs, we actually increase the likelihood of tensions. In other words, I could have a pistol in my drawer and be sure that it would only be used as a last resort. But when we institutionalize that last resort on a national level, it becomes more than a last resort. It becomes a pre-planned action. Yoder says that's a radical difference between these two cases, that in modern war, this last resort, instead of being a last resort, is a pre-planned event. And many people indeed are saying now that nuclear war is inevitable. The fourth point has to do with decisiveness. The probability that an individual at a given time will make a decision whether or not to be violent is very unlikely in a military situation. In war, it's all been planned out for you. In this case, it's a very real question. It's of the utmost importance. You can ask a person, what would you do if? It's not really an option that anyone at a specific time or place would make a free decision for or against war in a military situation. So Yoder says it's not representative of war where we're always preparing for it, and there's never that split second decisiveness to choose one or the other. So the decisiveness is not the same. We don't have that choice in modern warfare to decide what would you do if. Okay, the last point in this section is the guns and butter argument, I guess we could say. On the individual level, it doesn't really affect my life that much or my family's life if I keep a gun in my house, if I'm prepared to kill the attacker. It doesn't have much bearing on my life. But it has been demonstrated that turning a national economy over to a military-industrial complex has radical effects on the character of the nation's life. And all we have to do is look at the current budget shifts to see that social programs are being cut, the poor are being ignored. We're at 61% of our income tax dollar now goes for preparing for war or paying for past war. It's the very effort to defend freedom that we are sacrificing internal freedom. So it's the guns and butter argument. You can't have both. Money spent on the Trident submarine is not being spent on erosion of our topsoil. So the point of these all are to say that there's not necessarily a connection between modern warfare and this test case. You could be in favor, if you thought it was your Christian duty, you could be in favor of violently defending your wife and child on an individual level, but still be opposed to all modern war because they're different enough. And that's his major point in this section. Okay, now I'm going to erase this, and Yoder, this is where Yoder comes to the actual decision about what to do in this case. And the way the question is posed, such that it looks like there's only two options. It's a yes or no choice. The only choice is to defend myself and kill or at least seriously injure the other party, or the other option is non-defense, inaction, and permit the worst to happen. That's the way the question is posed, as if there are only two things that can happen. Yoder maintains, though, that there are more than two ways the story can turn out, and to present the question as if there are only two options is to really bias it and prejudice the question. So I want for us maybe to just now brainstorm about possible outcomes of this situation, and if we reacted one way or another way, what could possibly happen. Maybe I'll write down the first one, which we'll just say is tragedy, which means the killer just carries out his intentions. He kills my wife or my child or both. Catastrophe. It's something obviously that God would not want to happen. It's something that should be prevented at all cost. Something that if it happened, we would look upon it with horror forever. But I'll just outline tragedy. The killer succeeds. Any other possible outcomes?
It would also be tragedy if the killer were killed.
Okay. Let's see. Meaning that I try to kill the killer and I do succeed. And I do this out of my own authority, but I am confident somehow that I'm also doing it in the name of God, or that I will be somehow justified on the basis of self-defense. But that would also be a form of tragedy. Any other options?
Talk the killer out.
Okay. Another way out.
You silver tongue, guys.
Well, is that an option?
Yeah, they do that. They have special people that do that when the people are hostages. Yeah. But it takes a lot of training.
What are some of the ways you could, rise to some higher level of moral authority?
They often hope that the person has some conscience. Like, what would your mother think if she saw this dirty deed that you're doing? You're a coward attacking people weaker than you are. You're not a hero. You're just a lousy little wimp with a gun in your hand.
Okay.
I think more often they will talk about what will happen afterwards, think of the consequences.
Okay, consequences.
Aren't family members sometimes called in to try to persuade people who are holding hostages?
Although it doesn't quite fit the point, if we're in a sudden death situation here.
I think most of the time those people you try to talk them out of, you try to give them other options, as many options as they can.
Right. I mean, if the guy wants money, give him money.
Take my watch.
What about as a Christian? I mean, what about some sort of loving gesture? I mean, is that an impossibility? To perhaps the guy's going to change his mind if you look at that guy as an object of love, or is that totally irrational?
No, I don't think so. I think English bobbies not been armed for years, and many times they've gone in and the killers or whatever have been just so unnerved by the fact that the bobby assumed is placing himself in such danger. And I think you call it a loving gesture, I don't know what, but it seems to me that it strikes him somehow. I've heard of the killers over there killing themselves or shoot the unarmed bobby. He represents a figure that is almost like, I see Christ-like or whatever, that puts himself in danger. No other options.
I don't know that I would think of anything if I was in my bedroom and somebody was in there. I mean, I know how I feel if I'm walking down the street at night and I feel like somebody's following me. Mm-hmm. It's like,
that's how we're doing it now, before it comes up.
Yeah.
Because I don't know.
Yeah, so I think it does take training to face that type of situation.
That one of the things the other day was in nonviolent strategy. Let's say you were joining a nonviolent resistance movement. The training that you would assume for military action, people don't realize you would train just as vigorously in the aspects of nonviolence. And part of the reason mugging and housebreakings and all of that happen is you are without any kind of options or plans. You haven't been trained for that, right. So that the intruder always has the upper hand because you are just panicked or paralyzed. We had two instances in the Community of Christ, both of whom were women, and both of whom lived in the city and had thought through crisis situations. One was prepared and a strategy, the other was unprepared and just was a very fortunate experience. But the one, she was going into her door with the key, and a man came up behind her and said, "That's fine, honey, just put the key in, we're going in." And she immediately yelled at the top of her voice, she lived on a street where other people knew her, bit his thumb, and came back with her fist, just everything right away, and he ran. I mean, she was about 105 pounds, and yeah. He just thought he had an easy mark, and she was raised in New York. D.C. was nothing for her. The other one was one of our women was getting the Community of Christ basement ready for an evening event, and a guy came in with a nylon over his head and said, I want your purse, and we're going to have a party or something. And she thought it was a joke. She thought it was one of the neighborhood kids. So she just laughed and said, "Come on, I'm busy. Don't give me that crap. If you want to help, help." And he was so undone that he laughed. And when somebody saw him really running down the street and then came to see if she was all right, she hadn't even realized that her life was threatened. Now, if she had... Now, that would take a lot of discipline to unarm with humor and refuse to take seriously what that person was doing. But it did disarm him. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were very relieved. I don't know what she'd have done if she'd have really known that he was there. But
we did include some sort of non-lethal measures, like Ron Sider was here and said, who was a Mennonite, I think, and a pacifist, and he would say, I would not shoot the man. I might kick him. But I would not ever take a lethal measure. So I think you have to include that. Also, some sort of trip is possible. But as John said, none of these options are going to be possible if we're trigger happy. Probably not if we even have a gun in the house. These options are not going to be as likely as if we had just, at the beginning, ruled out the possibility of using violence at all. And they're probably more likely if we've been trained in nonviolent measures.
I worked with a lot of policemen all every day, and they'd always say to us, "Well, you gotta be really crazy for a fireman to go into a burning building." We always say, "You gotta be really crazy to be doing what you're doing." Mm-hmm. And they always carry a gun in their hip. And I saw so many, literally thousands of years, incidents of potential violence, of family arguments where we'd have to call the police in all the time. Usually they showed up anyway because it was always a chance. Mm-hmm. And their training, so I never saw, only saw policemen pull their guns maybe three times and had to use them. And they always, it was always in a, they have experts at talking people out of the violent situation. And they're not any, say, very special people other than they receive a training on how to deal with those situations. Mm-hmm. Where it's family situations are the most volatile.
And Yoder says even if you even ruled out any possibility of using a gun or a violent measure, you would even be more creative. That's his point.
That's what they are too. Really, they are very nonviolent in that sense. Mm-hmm. They really maintain their sense of humor and calmness, its demeanor that I could do it. And yet they say it's just a matter of training because. We receive training. That's why I'm maybe afraid to, but I'm confident I can go into a burning fire. The only thing is the training.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I believe my sense of humor has saved me a couple of times. I was in Los Angeles with lots of drunk blacks
and many others in the slums where I live, and a couple of blacks come up to me once, drunk, and says, "We're hungry. You got any money?" So I pull out my wallet, and I pull out a $5 bill, and I said, "Listen, don't waste this on food. I want you to buy yourself the best first-class muscatel there is." I said, "You know, I like to drink as much as you, but I'm such a stupid penny pincher that in many ways I'd rather give it to you than spend it on myself." And I waved that $5 bill in their face, and they giggled and laughed and wobbled away. And we left almost as friends. And if you can throw somebody off with an unusual response sometime, it sure does help. I've done that a couple of times, but this is getting away from your first example, though. But it is the best that I can do, and I think I've saved my neck twice that way. So wave a fiver and say, "Don't waste it on food, man."
A couple of times, though, Jim, you've been in danger of being hung here for your humor. So.
Yeah.
You have to balance that out. No, thanks. It's a good question. What about other, besides this kind of way up, what other kinds of possibilities could there be for it?
An attacker could be restrained.
Okay. How would...
neutralized. Some
by some non-lethal measure, okay. Mm-hmm. What about a miracle? Yoder calls it the providential way out, but I mean, do we throw that out completely, a miracle? I mean, whatever we think about it, it has been part of our Christian history as a way to think about the future.
Do we throw it out?
I mean, what else is our belief in resurrection that just when things look like they're not going to turn out a certain way, God saving action comes to life? And perhaps, you know, am I the tool for that? Or do we rule that out completely as Christians?
Yeah, maybe he has no bullets in his gun. Maybe somebody would stop over.
Yeah, I mean, a miracle may not end up being a miracle after a while. Maybe it can be explained by some natural causes, but at least I think we have to be open to that possibility. I mean, there are enough stories of miracles where, you know, I don't think we can rule it all.
If you're a sector on this thing right here, would you say just luck?
Luck, yeah.
Something else showed a providence.
A lot of times it couldn't be distinguished from any of these. Something could happen.
Just as we need training in nonviolence, I think, then also as Christians, we need to talk more about the possibility of miracles, mm-hmm. thing, and the providence of God.
That means faith, right? Faith that we're being taken care of, watched over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It has to do with a lot of things, healing and many other things.
What do we say when we say our future's in the hands of God? You know, if we rule out the possibility of any miracle ever happening, it's saying that is a bunch of bunk to say that we're in the hands of God. So to leave that option open, I think is important. What about just simply to be a martyr? I mean, isn't that an option? Martyrdom?
Yeah. Will that stop the killer from killing them?
Well, I mean, it's possible. There's two kinds. One would, I mean, we have to decide whether we're talking about martyrdom of the victim or martyrdom of myself. So.
I don't think.
And I'll use 5A and B. I mean, martyrdom, suffering, although it's seen as evil, has played a place. It has had a place in our history as Christians. I don't know. I don't think we can look upon the suffering of the innocent suffering of individuals as in every situation and at all times as being ultimately avoidable. Is that we should at all times at all costs avoid it, because sometimes suffering has played an important part of even the stance of the church or the character of the church. And Jesus suffered. Why not? Why don't we accept suffering on ourselves? What Yoder says about the victim being the martyr, some would say that suffering is pointless, that it would be evidence of the death of God or at least the evil nature of humanity. But in other instances, the slaughtering of innocents could possibly fit into a meaningful part of perhaps a renewed commitment on the part of the rest of us to work for a world in which that would never happen. And a lot of times when people die, their death is more important than their life was. It spurs people on to act in a different way. So to say that death should be avoided at all costs in all situations isn't consistent with our histories of the Christian Church.
We talked previously about intervention by God, and I think for martyrdom, charismata, the word for grace and gift, which we'll be talking about later too. One of those gifts is a gift, power of the Spirit to be a martyr.
Mm-hmm.
And we think about Stephen, and I think one time when it's described as the glory of God can be seen in Stephen, mm-hmm. and so forth. So again, almost to be a martyr, to have the courage to be that.
And a lot of times we see the death of the believer as being a special witness to the power of God.
Right. And the presence of God.
But that suffering ultimately is seen as evil, not that that's a positive, but it can work for it a different end. Bob mentioned.
But aren't we talking about a situation where a person might be able to intervene in someone else's martyring?
Yeah. Kind
of I'm giving two types of martyr. Perhaps the innocent victim just is a martyr and I don't know. If it's my wife, maybe my wife just steps in front of the guy and says, kill me.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it's kind of like you're saying, I'm going to let this person be a martyr.
Well, sometimes that's an option. Isn't that true with two of your friends? That not a martyr, but she was raped and he stood there and did not act in a sexually lethal, violent way, and she was raped.
That's correct. And that was...
their agreement.
They knew the values, both knew their values, and she was not... he did what she wanted him to do. That's correct. But boy, people misunderstand that one.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. Blame him.
Yeah.
They never questioned her and her decision, and that he was going along with what he knew she felt in regard to those kinds of situations. He took all the blame. That's again the roles, male, female, defending your wife.
Yeah. Kind of macho question.
Yeah.
The other one would be myself or the other person who's in the room as the martyr. This is what Bob was talking about. I think, and why not? Why not try to intervene in some way? I mean, not to lethally kill the attacker, but somehow focus his attention on yourself and let the other person escape. Why not risk your life for that other person? I mean, like Mike says, it's a natural assumption that in a fire or a flood or something like that, we would risk our life for another person. You know, wouldn't that be the first thing that we'd think about in this situation, is just putting ourselves in danger so that the other person could escape? I think that has to be an option for us. Any comments on that?
Yeah, the reason this is the hardest one, and I'm trying to do it in my own mind so maybe people can help. We made a strong point on Tuesday that satyagraha is not passive.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to undo any sense that nonviolence was weakness or passivity. The best way to do that is to see the Gandhi film. He just makes that so strong. Where is the difference between choosing martyrdom and having that as a form of power, and then martyrdom as passivity and not doing anything, and so you're killed? That's the hardest thing, to try to sense a difference.
These are clear-cut, I don't think they're clear-cut categories. I mean, you could put yourself in that position, and that could be a form of power that would disarm the attacker. I'm just saying these are all of the logical things that could possibly happen. I mean, you could end up being killed, and not that that would be a form of weakness, but in a lot of cases that would happen. But I'm trying to get past the notion that there's only two options.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but see, I guess my difficulty is, you're picturing something which is just so rare. I've never met anybody who faced the situation that they always say, what if? The first thing I say is, has that ever happened to you? Has that ever happened to anybody in the room? And it never has, so we talk about something that has happened to somebody in the room, which I think is okay to that question. But anyway, you think in terms of things happening so fast that I can't imagine What I see as martyrdom is simply inactivity, of doing nothing, and there's nothing positive about that in my mind. You see, yeah, I understand it's one of the five things. But
okay, I agree. I don't think it would be anything positive as far as active, but if we were to rank these as in terms of desirability of an outcome, you know, how would we rank them?
Miracle
first. No, I mean, okay.
Every time.
Okay, Karen talked about this one as being an evil. The killer being killed. I mean, ending a life. I mean, it would deprive that person of any chance of repentance or growth. I mean, that would be an evil. This one, in some people's mind, might be even more of an evil, since it justifies the killing of this person in a lot of people's minds. So these two would obviously be evil. There's one more option that we haven't talked about, is that, and it's related to this one, is that I try to kill the killer, but I really don't. I'll just put unsuccessful.
Unsuccessful defense, or what do you mean?
Unsuccessful attempt. To kill. I mean, it's got to be a logical possibility. In Yoder says this perhaps could be the greatest evil, that I try to defend the innocent, but I fail to do so and only make matters worse. And he says if the attacker can overcome my force, my gun or whatever, and he says it's probably pretty likely since the attacker's prepared and you're not. Or if the attacker is really driven by something insane so that he won't stop for fear or pain, which is also likely since in the original question we don't give any reason for the attacker to be there. I mean, we're assuming that the guy's insane. Or if he's a better shot than I am, then my effort to stop him with his kind of weapons might very well make things worse. And not only might he kill both of us, but he might become further enraged and go on and kill more people. So I say, you know, this could be the worst of all options, an unsuccessful killing. I mean, we could wound the guy and he could go on and kill me, kill my wife, go on and kill other people. So that we have to leave that open as an option too.
So in other words,
it's also one of the most likely ones.
Well, that's what Yoder says. I mean, if the guy is prepared, if he's really insane, we can't assume that our taking up his methods are really going to bring the desired result. Karen?
If John's friend, the woman who bit his thumb and screamed, is that an example of what you're talking about? Maybe she wouldn't have succeeded? That maybe he wouldn't have been frightened and he would have been more violent because she screamed and bit his thumb?
Could have been. I think it would more often happen if you were a real threat to that person with a gun and shot at that person, didn't kill him. Many times that ends up being much worse. And to leave that open is an option. Okay, Yoder says this one, and this one would all be undesirable. We wouldn't want those to happen. None of these would we want to happen, but they're more morally permissible than the other three. 3, 4, and 5, A and B. I mean, if we're going to rank those for desirability, that's how we're going to rank them. These 3, 4, and 5, I don't think we can really rank, but at least we can say that those would be more morally permissible than the other three. Am I right in that? And Yoder says that it becomes evident, now when we look at this, that if I exercise the option to attempt to kill the attacker, I really close the door to all three of these possibilities. If I try to kill that attacker, this can't happen, this can't happen, and that can't happen if I try to kill that attacker. None of those could happen if I choose to seek to kill. This means that I must not trust God to work things out along the lines of any of these, or a miracle, meaningful suffering. It means that I don't trust myself to be creative enough to find another way out. And further, it opens the door to the worst of all possible outcomes, which would be this one. That could not happen unless I decided to kill that person. Yoder says to renounce trying to kill the attacker would be the path of trust and faith, because it leaves the door open to a miracle, providence and or martyrdom. It is not lazy. It faces the challenges of creating another way out, and it's also responsible for it prevents the worst. We have no way to estimate how probable any of these outcomes are, but at least we have, I think we have shown that it's outrageous to assume that there's only one or two options in this situation. And it's only that one that leads to the worst of all evils. And it's only my effort to kill the attacker that closes the door on all the other possibilities happening, the positive outcomes. I think open it up and see what people
think. Knowingly that you attack the killer, knowing that you will die, is that not martyrdom?
I'm not sure if martyrdom means dying.
You sacrifice your life, it's not martyrdom, knowingly that you will die.
Like if you step in front of the gun as it's going off?
No, he's saying
attacking the killer.
If you're attacking, I don't think that's
knowing that
martyrdom.
You will die.
I think that's different. Well, maybe technically you're okay on here.
If you go into an attack somebody, you know that it's a suicidal attack, but that will save other lives.
I think maybe what you're pointing out is that Yoder, I'm sure I know what Yoder means by five, and he means the refusal to try to kill. But I think maybe we do refer to martyr as one who fought and died. Yeah. So that means that five has to be framed.
Means that they'll save some people someplace else, perhaps.
Where does five and one?
That's exactly my question.
Yeah. I have a real hard time distinguishing between that.
Uh huh.
Exactly. What do you think?
Oh, well, in one, he does nothing. Whereas in five, he says, well, kill me. He self-challenges.
That's what I was saying. The difference between being passive and letting it happen and choosing to give your life is so hard to picture in this situation where there's no talk, no long period of time, no other witnesses to it.
It's a shift of vocabulary. Mike said it so well. The devout Christian can say miracle. An ordinary guy in Santa Rosa, California says luck. An ordinary guy says tragedy under the circumstances. A Christian with Christ as the model could use number five. Is that not possible?
Yeah. Certainly enough. Whenever we talk, whenever we have discussions, we always take it in Christian context. Most of the time, I think here Holden. The same discussion could be thought of a philosophical separate terms.
I think the difference is permitting this to happen is seen as an action, as being lazy or inactive. And this one is perhaps choosing that alternative as being the lesser of other evils.
But
does that
how can
sense?
You just lie back? I mean, then the first one is just another word saying, well, I can't do anything anyway, so I'll just die? Is that the mentality?
Or let that other person die?
I think Yoder's six options fit better on almost every other case study, and that's not his problem. What he's pointing is this is a poor case study. First of all, it doesn't happen.
Okay,
and
all right.
So I was thinking, let me give you an example, because I've used it before, and I'm not, I wish Catherine Cove had come. She was going to come this week. The one who was in Iran for all those days, and then she just wrote, it didn't work, but she really wanted a week at home. And I was thinking, when that happened, and it's easy for me to sit over here and say what should have happened or could have happened, but take that one as the case study, then look at the options. When that happened, I said to some friends, the one thing the Iranians can count on is that we will not be nonviolent. That's the way that they held us hostage. Can you imagine a scenario? As soon as those 44 people were taken hostage, all of them went on a fast unto death. Immediately, fast unto death, and we sent food for the hungry Iranians, any of them, while our 44 were fasting unto death. Can you imagine world opinion? If those 44 had really been willing to die freely, now you're choosing martyrdom. And then you have the power, all that power of self-giving love brought to bear in an international situation. No, they knew have those helicopters that didn't work and SWAT teams, we could have had thousands of people die rather than 44 who refused to eat. But they knew we wouldn't do that. And gosh, I'm saying I'm going to be one of those 44. But that's what that would have been, the kind of, now look at the options. Tragedy, killers killed, Iranians killed by our SWAT troops, or them killing all 44.
Doesn't it seem then like we have the duty to look for those other options rather than to close the door on any of those possibilities happening? If we're violent, we really close the door on any of that happening. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that's your
point.
I think
that's
point.
The strongest point. Violence closes the door.
Yeah. This is the way he puts it. By assuming that it is my business to prevent or bring judgment upon evil, I authorize myself to close the door upon the possibilities of reconciliation and healing. And I take into my own hands to guarantee that events will not turn out in a way that is painful or disadvantageous to me or illegal. I close off the possibilities of reconciliation which might have been let loose in the world.
This is so true of war, because we make this judgment, we close the door, we're going to fight, and we instantly close the door to any other option.
The question is, does our Christian faith call us to go this far? I mean, it seems like it's really a long way to go down the line in being faithful, and it doesn't seem like, at least at first glance, it's going to be very effective. Does our faith call us to not only just be nice to our enemy, but to actually, where the enemy becomes a privileged object of love? Does the gospel call us to that?
I think it does, and I think it also calls us to talk, to be informed about what the alternatives are. I mean, once when I was 18, someone broke into my parents' house, and I was alone with a friend, and she woke me up and she was laughing and she was hysterical. I didn't realize that, but she said, "I hear somebody walking up the stairs," and I thought she was just joking, so I got up and I got to the bedroom door, and sure enough, I didn't see anybody, but I heard them, and my first response was to grab a can of hairspray from my parents' bathroom, thinking that I would just do something. But I had no training whatsoever in how do you respond to a situation like this. So I think, yeah, our faith calls us to that, but also to talk it through like we're doing now, and mm-hmm. and to carry on that conversation. What are the alternatives? And some real practical examples, or with the practical examples.
That's what I say. I still don't trust myself. This conversation, I don't trust myself to be able to react the way I would like to. Say that I do as a Christian person.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't think Yoder does either. In fact, I'm going to read his final quote. It says, "I do not know what I would do if some insane criminal brute were to attack my wife and child. But I do know what I should do would be illuminated by what God, my father, did when his only begotten son was being threatened, or what Abraham, my father in the faith, was ready to sacrifice out of obedience. Abraham could bring himself to readiness to give up his son. The writer to the Hebrews tells us, anachronistically, because he believed in the resurrection. It was, quote, for the sake of the joy that was set before him, that Christ himself would endure the cross. My readiness, not in the contemplation of my moral strength, but in the confession of the nature of the God who has revealed himself in Jesus Christ. My readiness to accept as my duty that kind of love is founded in no craving for heroism and no self-confidence, not in proud enthusiasm, nor in masochism. Is founded doctrinally in the confession that he who gave his life at our hands was at the same time the revelation of that true manhood which is God's instrument in the world." So it's completely based on faith. And you know, is that something that we're called to do in that situation?
This is an aside, and that's the better ending, but I should have said it earlier. Annie, his wife, who's very quiet, just a beautiful woman, thin French woman, didn't marry him for a while because she wasn't sure he would protect her if someone broke into their country. Her face just lit up and she kidded him because she knew what a pacifist he was, and she wasn't sure about marrying somebody. So this case study was part of his engagement process when he married
her. In her family, her brothers had been in concentration camps, and she had a hard time overcoming hatred for the German people and had to struggle through that.
Maynard, you have a lot of rich experience. You would like to hear some of it.
session's over.
It's 10:20. But tomorrow we're going to take up now, is there any way to incorporate nonviolence into, in a larger scale, to our national defense? And that may sound even more crazy, but perhaps not as crazy as the current wisdom of the day.